Should the state be able to have voters erase a city? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The city of Opa-locka has been in trouble for years. City finances are overseen by an independent board. A FBI corruption investigation a few years ago led to 7 people convicted, and the city needs millions of dollars in infrastructure repairs. Now there's a legislative effort that would force residents to vote on dissolving cities in Florida under certain circumstances. Plus this week, a professor at the University of Miami who's an expert on money laundering was charged with laundering dirty money from Venezuela. And if you're a Broward County voter, did you get a letter from the election supervisor? The letter threatened a final notice to inactive voters. The election bosses apologized, but what led to the notices? And will Broward County be ready for another big election in less than a year? The South Florida Roundup made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The city of Opa-locka in North Miami-Dade County has faced its share of problems recently, namely corruption and financial mismanagement. Some state lawmakers are now calling for legislation that would create a path for the city, perhaps to shut itself down. The potential measure would specify circumstances that could trigger a municipal vote for dissolution. Let's talk about this here on the South Florida Roundup with Palm Beach State Representative Michael Caruso. He is from the PBS affiliate in WXCL in Boynton Beach. Representative Caruso serves on the statewide auditing committee that's recommending this legislation. Representative Caruso, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you back on the program. We want to ask you about the possible legislation that you have discussed regarding allowing municipal voters essentially to vote to erase their city. Is this specifically directed at Opa-locka?
Well, I think it might have arisen as a result of our committee findings with regard to Opa-locka. But no, there's other cities that are out there, other small municipalities that are in similar situations or nearing those situations that, are kind of stuck in a position where, they're just having financial troubles. And this will give the citizens of those cities a chance to make it possible. You know, Tom, right now, most of the cities and charters allow for a special act or for their citizens to sign a petition or take other actions to request that their city's elected officials set a referendum for dissolution. But then there's the whole idea that it exposes those individuals, publicly. And exposes them to what? Well, when they sign a petition in favor of such a special act, then their names are public as the people that want to go forward and dissolve their own city. And what are proposed the legislation that's being considered now is would keep those thoughts private.
Because it would be a vote as opposed to a signature on a petition for a public referenda.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
So you, to some degree, unsatisfied with the path that's laid out right now for citizens to decide if they want to dissolve their local municipality. What are the criteria, though, that you would suggest you and your fellow lawmakers set in this legislation that you're calling for?
Well, I think the criteria would probably revolve around the same criteria that's out there for financial, emergencies of different municipalities that we already look at. There's right now we have 4 conditions of financial emergency, and I think if they fall under any one of those 4 conditions, they are subject to audit by the FEB.
And the FEB is what again?
The Financial Emergency Board.
Right. So there's already those kinds of triggers involved, right, for state involvement
in local government, especially at the financial level. And most of this is geared toward city finances, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, possibly we create legislation that allows, once any one of those four conditions are triggered, gives a city to opt out of their city charter if they want,
and
or
what
at
would
least
be the
call for a vote.
To at least call for a vote, right. Representative Michael Caruso is along with us from WXAL in Boynton Beach. Representative Caruso from Palm Beach County, sitting on a joint legislative committee that is asking other House and Senate committees in Florida to consider a piece of legislation that would allow local voters to vote on whether or not to erase their city under certain circumstances. A lot of this coming about because of the troubles around Opa-locka. Wondering if folks who have done work in that community, live in that community, are involved here, would like to hear their voices be heard. 800-743-WLRN, that's our telephone number to join the conversation. 800-743-9576. You could also text us, 786-786-7636. Home rule is a big idea, certainly here in South Florida, and lots of concerns about what this kind of effort would mean for home rule. 786-786-7636, that's the text line. Representative Caruso, what about home rule? Does this reinforce it or does it violate it, do you think?
Well, Tom, you're hitting some trigger points for me. you know, and before I move on to home rule and Opa-locka, I just wanted to say that, you know, Opa-locka is a 100-year-old city, or almost a 100-year-old city, and they've got a long, rich history of pride among their residents. And I want to give Opa-locka every opportunity to continue its charter. And we want to just leave it up to the people of Opa-locka. So there's nothing more home rule than letting the people of the city decide.
Has there been conversations with you from citizens that would like to erase the city but are concerned about the public nature of a petition that could lead to a public referendum?
Strangely, no. I haven't. Nobody's reached out to me from Opa-locka.
So nobody's voiced concerns about the public nature of the petition process?
No.
No,
I haven't heard a thing. I haven't heard a thing.
And
Opa-locka, Tom, it's a mess right now. I mean, it is what we learned in committee and what I've researched thereafter is just it's mind-boggling.
There is certainly a long list of financial difficulties, to put it mildly, for Opa-locka. Jay Weaver is also along with us here, Representative. Jay is a legal court reporter, among many other things, for their partner, the Miami Herald. He is deep in the weeds on lots of big issues, including this one. Jay, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
The representative mentioned some of the big problems that Opa-locka is facing. Give us kind of a quick back of the envelope about the state of Opa-locka as an ongoing concern.
Well, the state representative is absolutely correct in his analysis. But here's the issue. You had a governor appoint a financial emergency oversight board in the summer of 2016, mainly because the city was not only going bankrupt, but was insolvent, could not pay its bills, could not pay its employees, could not sustain itself. And over time, the city has gone through what was once a very corrupt period where the FBI came in and, you know, arrested and the U.S. Attorney's Office charged and convicted some seven, you know, individuals associated with bribery and extortion at City Hall. And it involved a former city manager and a city commissioner, and the city was dysfunctional. But all of that passed with the election of 2018, and you had a new reform-minded group that came in. Despite their political will to cure the city of everything that ails it, to the representative's point, it is still a dysfunctional city. It is so deep in debt. It has such a completely, you know, inoperable infrastructure system. When I say infrastructure, I mean roads that are just, you know, unpassable.
Absolutely.
Systems that don't drain. You have water systems that don't work. You have pumping stations to, you know, deal with the gravity of sewage flowing through the city that are not working. You can't build anymore in that city. because of all these problems. And these costs are not millions of dollars. They're tens of millions of dollars, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's just physical infrastructure. And then on top of that, you have operational needs and operational issues.
Right.
They're already tapped out with their military. They're as high as they can go.
Yeah, so they're at a 10 mil.
They don't have any sources of revenue. They don't.
So no sources of revenue, climbing costs. That is obviously not a pretty financial picture. Representative Caruso, you know, is there the potential of some kind of legal filing? In other words, you know, should the village, the city, be considering a bankruptcy of some kind? In your estimation, you've seen these numbers.
Well, Tom, Jay hit it spot on. You know, what we have is we have health issues down there. You know, when lift stations are, you know, fail and can't pump waste, and you know, water. The water lines, I think Inspector General Miguel, she highlighted 186,000 feet of pipes are ready to implode. We've got black mold in city structures that make some of the buildings unusable. We've got a desperate situation. You know, tens of millions. I spoke to Mayor Pigott after the committee meeting where he spoke, and I sensed that we were somewhere between $100 and $300 million of infrastructure needs. And he said, Representative, you're spot on. That's probably what we need. And that's a situation. That's a hurdle that it may be too big to overcome.
So how does allowing voters, allowing citizens to vote on dissolution address that, that otherwise may not be an avenue open?
Well, should the voters elect to dissolve their city charter, the land mass of the city would become part of under the control of the county.
You'd become unincorporated Miami-Dade County.
It'd be unincorporated Miami-Dade County, exactly.
And so would those liabilities then be absorbed by the county?
Well, it would become their problem. But I feel more comfortable with the state allocating funds to Miami-Dade County for purposes of bringing the infrastructure back up to code. And to par, than I do in feeding this continuing hole that Opelika's created.
So it sounds like to some degree a level of trust, Representative, a trust by the legislature when it decides to allocate funds to Opelika, trust.
When the legislature allocates money anywhere, we have to do it equitably. And fairly for all the citizens of the state of Florida. And so to keep throwing good money after bad, you know, it doesn't serve anybody's purpose.
Is it bad money if essentially an independent group is in charge of the finances of the city now,
well,
of Opelika?
That's the problem. That's the exact problem that we have. The current situation with the FEB, they're only allowed to monitor and supervise and approve invoices that are paid and things like that. But you know, you mentioned earlier, they don't have control of the checkbook. And without control of the checkbook, I just feel the situation continuing to amass itself. For example, When I first sat in on the committee meeting where it was first brought to our attention, who was speaking at that point? Chair Fisher. That's right. It was a House meeting. Chair Fisher's opening statement was that we're not there to chastise or rebuke the prior commissioners and mayors for getting Opelika to where it is today, but we were to look, you know, at the situation as ongoing, going forward, and that we had a new commission there, a new mayor elected in 2018, and that they had a different attitude. And then during that meeting, here's what's key to me. What was key to me during that first meeting is that I looked towards the – I wanted to hear the intention and the manner by which the mayor and other commissioners there were representing themselves to see if they were working with the inspector general or working against the inspector general. And the inspector general, she brought up one situation and where we heard that the city mayor had proposed a $25,000 headhunter fee to hire a new city manager. And the inspector general, when she got that request, did not approve that outlay, that financial outlay of $25,000 for a headhunter. To get a new city manager.
Yeah.
And so the testimony that we heard from the Inspector General Miguel was that the city mayor responded, the new city mayor, who was supposed to be working together with the inspector general under a new, new attitude, a new approach to this whole matter, to resolve it. The inspector general, the city mayor would, quote, fire the existing city manager tomorrow and you can come in and play city manager.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think that's not the right approach to the right, work. It's not working together. And then to top it off, we then heard how not only did they pay a headhunter $25,000 without approval, then they went on to invite every city manager candidate. They flew them into the city. Mm-hmm. They put them up in hotels. They held a banquet for them, paid their airfare, held a banquet for them. And then they've yet to provide any backup documentation for those expenses to the inspector general. So I'm feeling that, wow. Same old, same old.
Yeah, not a lot of trust I can hear from your description there. Let me just remind folks that this is the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm talking with State Representative Michael Caruso. You just hear him there. His district is including parts of Palm Beach County. He also serves on a statewide auditing committee, and some lawmakers are pushing for legislation that would allow a vote on the dissolution of cities in Florida, like Opa-locka, which has been experiencing lots of financial trouble over the past many years. I will state that WLRN did invite city officials of Opa-locka to participate on this program today. A legislative aide with the mayor's office said the mayor and city manager would not participate without the representation of state lawmakers whose districts include Opa-locka. Representative Caruso, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't understand it. I think it goes along with what I just spoke of. It's non-cooperation, and here we have an opportunity to everybody speak their mind, publicly, like we do everything in the state capitol, and in the cities, and they're not here to counter or agree or disagree.
If you are to move forward with this effort to get legislation through the Florida legislature that would allow voters to vote on whether or not they want to dissolve their communities, such as Opa-locka, how important is it for that effort to find support from Florida lawmakers who represent Opa-locka?
Well, I would have loved to have them participate. I think it's important that everybody participate in this the whole process.
But that piece of legislation, could obviously get through the House and the Senate and go to Governor DeSantis's desk without Democratic support. But for you as a member of the legislature, is it important for this piece of legislation, should it get pushed forward, to have support from Opa-locka, the city that is likely to be first in line for this kind of vote?
Well, the law that we would create would be a law that would pertain to the entire state of Florida and not directed at Opa-locka at all. And so just to give cities and the people of the cities, the citizens of the municipalities, the option to either dissolve their city under these manners, you know, by vote versus by petition now. And you know, there are the options. There's other options outside of that. One of the options I'd consider and that would keep the city intact is to place the city under a temporary receivership of the Inspector General's office. Let the Inspector General control the checkbook. And then, you know, then I would be more apt to vote for an appropriation or a loan by the state of Florida to the city for these infrastructure improvements. They need $100 million today to get their just to get the bare minimum, to get it up to operating status.
Jay Weaver with the Miami Herald, how about that idea? Other options open to Opa-locka? What do you think the kind of reception would be at Opa-locka City Hall from the representative's idea?
Look,
there?
Look, there's always going to be pushback from Opa-locka local officials and Opa-locka state representatives. They're going to circle the wagon. But the reality is this city and its residents have wanted to dissolve the city in the past. There was a an inchoate initiative petition a few years back to dissolve the city. It didn't go anywhere because there wasn't enough political will. That was driven more by the disgust with corruption at City Hall. That corruption seems to have come and gone, but the city, again, is inoperable. The only way this whole situation can work, in my view, is for the county to take over the city or the state, but I think the county would be better. And the reason I say this is the county has a longstanding relationship with the city in terms of providing its water and sewer services. And so the county has already come in and taken over the billing practices for the city. The county is owed already $5 to $10 million. They have a huge stake in the future of Opa-locka. And technically speaking, and by that I mean professional managers, engineers, accountants, public administrators, you need pros like you have at Miami-Dade County Hall to run the city of Opa-locka. They, you know, with all due respect to, you know, the administrators in Opa-locka, they have never been and never will be ready for prime time. They just don't have the technical ability or the know-how or the political will, and the commission won't support them either that way. The old commission was worse. This one is better. But again, you literally have to completely turn this city over to county control. The question is, does the county want it?
Right, right.
There are great advantages to this city. Believe it or not, guys, it has great infrastructure. It has an airport.
Right.
It is centrally located.
Mm-hmm.
It has commercial viability. But with all these infrastructure problems and tax problems and operational revenue problems, you can't attract a lot of new business there, you know, with the exception of, you know, Amazon over at the airport. But that's county problem.
As a fulfillment center. Jay, you bring up a really good point. I wanted to put that to you, Representative Caruso. The legislation that you're calling for would allow residents of a city, of a municipality, to vote on whether or not they wanted to dissolve. If that were to happen in an Opa-locka, for instance, it would be the next layer of government, essentially, that would absorb that, in this case, Miami-Dade County. But those residents, perhaps, for instance, would not get a say whether or not they want to absorb the liabilities and the challenges of these municipalities.
Well, I think those residents of Opa-locka are already residents of the county.
Certainly that's true, yes. Yes, that is true.
You know, I think Jay's made a great point, you know, outside of the Inspector General, you know, taking over receivership of the city, I'd be happy with the county doing the same. So Miami-Dade is certainly qualified too. You know, they're very qualified and a major stakeholder in this to want to work this city's financial matters out.
A fascinating story with a lot of human cost here for the residents of Opa-locka, certainly. Representative Michael Caruso, representing parts of Palm Beach County, with us from WXEL in Boynton Beach. Representative, great to have you on the program again. Thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom. And you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, we focus so hard on the mayor and the council people, the councilmen and women of Opa-locka. This is really about the people of Opa-locka, 100%, and what's best for them. And right now we need to get their infrastructure that serves them, both the, you know, electric, water, sewage, everything, that, you know, all city functions, back up to par. And they're the ones that are hurt most by it. They are the ones, period, that are hurt by this.
Representative Caruso, thanks again for your time. Have a happy Thanksgiving in the week ahead.
Jay you Weaver, too, Tom.
Jay
you
Weaver
too,
with our partner, the Miami Herald. Jay, stick around. We got another topic here to talk about here on the Florida Roundup this week. It is the case of a University of Miami expert on crime in the Americas charged with laundering dirty cash from Venezuela. That's ahead with the South Florida Roundup next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week.
Not guilty. That's how I'm feeling. They've got it all wrong. Not guilty.
That's University of Miami professor Bruce Bagley. He was speaking on CBS4 on Monday of this week after news broke that he'd been charged with laundering dirty cash originally coming out of Venezuela. The irony is that Bagley is one of the top experts on crime in the Americas. He wrote a book entitled Drug Trafficking, Organized Crime, and Violence in the Americas Today. That was in 2015. Federal prosecutors say he collected about $3 million in his bank accounts and kept nearly $300,000 for himself, the rest going to unnamed people. WLRN spoke with Bagley's defense attorney, Daniel Foeman, this week.
We're evaluating the evidence. We're evaluating the charges that have been leveled and having discussions with the authorities in New York. And we're hopeful that at the end of the day that Dr. Bagley is going to be vindicated.
We'll be talking about this case and the case of dirty money from Venezuela. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. That's the voice line. You could text us your thoughts at 786-786-7636. Questions about money laundering and Miami's place in this global cycle. 786-786-7636. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett joins us. Jay Weaver from the Miami Herald still with us as well. Tim and Jay, before we talk about this indictment that was unsealed on Monday this week, Tim, tell us what kind of source Bagley was. He was well known in the South Florida community in the Americas for this expertise that he developed over decades.
He was one of the best known, not only here in South Florida, but in the nation and internationally. International newspapers quoted him extensively whenever they were trying to understand Latin American politics and more specifically just the ugliness of Latin American organized crime and drug trafficking.
And how far did that expertise stretch in terms of the topic?
Throughout the region. You would often find Bruce not only being quoted by international media, but he would be on forums all the time discussing whether it was Mexico, whether it was Colombia, Venezuela, Brazil. He knew this hemisphere and its nefarious underbelly perhaps better than any academic I've ever known, and I've been turning to Bruce as a source for 25 years.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. You've used him, sources on and off the record, I imagine, through the years.
Oh, we've had him extensively here on WLRN.
In this studio that you and I are sitting in right now.
Earlier this year when Colombia and Venezuela were rattling sabers at each other. Bruce was the first person I thought to come in and help explain this to people.
And your reaction when you saw the news, the indictment in the Southern District of New York?
I was shell-shocked because your first reaction is if anyone should have understood the precariousness of getting into a situation like this, it would have been Bruce Bagley.
So, Jay Weaver, walk us through this indictment that came out of New York City toward Professor Bagley here. What are the charges?
Well, the charges are conspiracy to commit money laundering and money laundering. But what isn't totally clear is whether this was a sting operation by the FBI from beginning to end, or that sting developed during the course of the money laundering, the so-called money laundering conspiracy. And I say that because to step back, you know, so listeners understand, you have a situation where, you know, Professor Bagley is accused of conspiring with another unnamed individual by receiving money from another unnamed individual. He's a Colombian. And the money's coming from overseas. It's coming from two companies. One is a food company. One is a wealth management company. One is in the United Arab Emirates, and the other one is Switzerland. So right there, you've got this international setting. And the money coming in is coming into Bruce Bagley's bank account in Weston. And he's receiving $200,000 more or less each time. And somehow the bank, naturally, through suspicious activity reports, reports this to the Fed. The Feds, I think, start developing an investigation at that point. It could have already been underway, but my guess is it began toward the end of 2018. The charges are that Bagley and individual number one, you know, collaborated and talked about how the funds were from foreign corrupt activities in Venezuela, from foreign bribery, from embezzlement from the government. It doesn't go much into more detail than that. But what's interesting is that it's represented to Bruce Bagley that this is the source of the funds.
Yeah.
So he should know better. Yeah. And that's where it gets a little murky because, you know, you don't know how long this had been going on historically or whether the FBI introduced the concept of the foreign, the tainted foreign money in order to take him down. And he did this 14 times. He received about $200,000 each time. In the course of this, one bank account was closed, and he reopened another one. And each time the money came in, he kept 10% and then would make the balance payable to this individual one. All the money was coming in from a second individual, the Colombian. Mm-hmm. And who these people are and what their roles are, unknown. But I am of the belief that individual one that was collaborating with him is a proactive, cooperating witness or source who probably got jammed up by the Fed in some sort of criminal activity involving money laundering and then started to focus on Bruce Bagley. Now, what's shocking in coming full circle is that he would have taken any money from any international source because, as Tim pointed out, he knows the rules of money laundering, and he knows you don't take sums of money from a foreign source. And obviously, it set off alarm bells.
Well, we have learned, and I'll go back to Jay pointing out that the main figure in this scheme, alleged scheme, is a Colombian businessman. And he was the one, according to the indictment, sending the money to Bruce's account in Weston from the United Arab Emirates and Switzerland. We have learned from several sources close to Bruce that Bruce was doing consulting work for this Colombian businessman, who the sources believe was a very controversial Colombian businessman named Alex Saab. And Alex Saab, to call him controversial, and I think Jay would agree with me because Jay also knows that back in July, Alex Saab was indicted here
in
the
Miami,
Southern District
right.
of Florida for being one of the major players in the kind of corruption in dealing with Venezuela that's also at the heart of this case. Alex Saab was indicted here this past summer for being involved in a scheme to a bribery and kickback and currency exchange fraud scheme that involved about $375 million in schemes like getting contracts for affordable housing in Venezuela that was never really provided. And even worse, contracts to provide food to the government food program in Venezuela at greatly inflated prices, and again, involving kickbacks. Mm-hmm. So Bruce, according to sources that we've spoken to very close to him, tell us that he was doing consulting work for Alex Saab. And somehow, and again, we go to this question of how could Bruce have not thought that this would be dangerous, somehow agreed to this sort of payment arrangement where he would receive these large amounts of money, take his cut for his consulting payment, and then cut a check for the rest to this other individual that Jay was referring to. Again, it just boggles the mind that Bruce could have gotten into this.
The indictment that was unveiled this week certainly exists in this environment of a federal focus on money laundering. Miami's being a hot role right. in it with this dirty money coming out of Venezuela for various reasons through the years. Is there any sense that this case is part of a larger scenario that the feds and the FBI and others are looking at?
Well, I would just say, and I would ask Jay if he would agree with this, when you look at, for example, an individual like Alex Saab, who was involved in corruption involving hundreds of millions of dollars with Venezuela, and Bruce is involved allegedly in a scheme that only involved, you know, a fraction of that, maybe $3 million, right. It would seem to me then that they're targeting Bruce as someone who can help them get to a wider span of people.
Jay, what do you think?
I agree. It is either that, or he is someone that they learned about through the investigation of Alex Saab, because Saab, as Tim pointed out, was involved in various programs that that clearly were designed to divert money from the Venezuelan people, intended for good things, affordable housing, food programs, things of that nature, but then it ended up lining his pockets. And so going back to the point, I do think that they discovered Bruce Bagley in the course of the Saab investigation. And I do think they obviously targeted him, you know, in recent months because, you know, he is who he is. He's not just anybody. He's this major UM Latin American crime expert, lecturer, and very well known in the community. There's tremendous irony, and there was a kind of a snark in the press release issued by the Southern District of New York suggesting he's going to learn an object lesson now, and now he's going to face some tenure in the federal justice system, you know. And it was kind of curious the way they went after him that way, because normally the tone is more neutral. But the amount of money, as Tim pointed out, is not large. It's small. And he obviously should have, and it's shocking that he didn't know better.
Small in relation to the other allegations that have existed out there of tens of millions of dollars.
But I think that Professor Bagley could potentially help. But Saab is obviously the bigger target. Now, he's at large. I don't think he's left, I don't think he's been extradited yet.
No.
In fact, I know he hasn't.
Well, Colombia has put out an Interpol request for his arrest there. But I spoke this week to a Venezuelan investigative news outlet called Armando Info, which has done probably the most exhaustive investigations of Alex Saab. And they're pretty sure that he's laying low in Venezuela. Not only laying low, but helping the Maduro regime concoct new business schemes to help that regime circumvent U.S. economic sanctions, setting up businesses in Turkey, for example. And so they also, at Armando.info, they also can't believe that Bruce could have gotten involved with a guy like Alex Saab, and if he had done his due diligence, not know that he was messing with fire.
Right. And to your point, Tim, real quickly, they already have the big target, Saab, in terms of having indicted him. And there are sanctions against all these programs and companies. So it is one major case of many, as you know, involving Venezuelan kleptocracy that's in the billions of dollars.
Right.
Money diverted all over the world into Switzerland, into Malta, into the Emirates. That's what makes this so shocking. I don't know what Bruce Bagley knows, though. You know, he seems like kind of a small fish in a very large pond in this whole thing, you know? I mean, he's almost a minnow. I don't understand what his opportunity will be to cooperate or what he can offer. I mean, he seems to me someone who they went after they learned about him and his probably small role as a consultant in all of this. I would like to know who the cooperating, proactive source was who recorded him and help the feds take him down.
Individual one, right?
Yeah, individual one in the indictment that was announced this week. A real window, obviously, into this broader issue and the broader investigations, multiple investigations into the hundreds of millions of dollars of dirty money out of Latin America and Miami's role that it has played. Jay Weaver, reporter with our partner, the Miami Herald. Jay, always great to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Tim Padgett, America's editor here at WLRN. Timothy, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
We got plenty more to come. Broward County Elections Office sending out a final notice to thousands of voters that their registration status could be canceled. Did you get one of those letters? Stick around. We're going to talk about it next on the South Florida Roundup. Welcome back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The Broward County Elections Office has a long history of challenges around this time of year. Last year, it was dealing with the crucial recount on a couple of statewide races. Remember that? Well, the office has dealt with another more recent blunder. More than 50,000 voters received what was called a final notice mailer, threatened to designate them as inactive voters. The election supervisor in Broward County, Pete Ananachi, later apologized for the mailer and said no one's status will change. Did you get one of these letters, one of these final notice voting mailers? What was your reaction? How did you deal with it? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Is Broward County ready for another big election in less than 1 year's time? Text us, 786-786-7636. The text line, 786-786-7636. Larry Barchefsky is along with us with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel on the telephone this week. Larry, welcome back to the Roundup. Tell us about this final notice. How did it get sent out?
Hi, Tom. Well, what the supervisor's office did in September was send out a brochure to every single voter in the county. It was basically an informational brochure telling them about the upcoming election date, how to register for vote by mail. But a second part that this mailer does is the post office is told not to forward it if the address is incorrect or if there's a problem with the address. So more than 100,000 mailers got sent back to the post office as undeliverable. And from these, the supervisor said 54,000 were sent this final notice saying, hey, you don't live at the address you said you lived at. We're gonna put you on this inactive list unless we hear from you.
Is there such a thing as a final notice for voters who are registered?
Well, it's there could be a final notice. What the supervisor said was this is not the notice that should have been sent out.
Yeah.
Instead, what should have been sent out was more just an information thing. Hey, there might be a problem with the address you have on file with our office. Can you please check and verify that we have your correct address?
Yeah, much more diplomatic, a lot less scary for voters, right? So how did that language on that mailer get kind of put into the pipeline?
That language is eventually used somewhere down the line when they're getting close to really putting somebody on the inactive list. But what the supervisor said, they have a separate system that they use through the state that handles all their voter information things, and that this system plugged in automatically determined that this was the letter that should have been sent out, and the supervisor Ananachi said, no, that is not the letter that should have gone out. And so he was still in the process of checking to find out how that happened, how instead of a polite asking for your correct address didn't go out, and instead this more dramatic notice did.
Yeah, dramatic. One way to put it, certainly. Larry Barchefsky is along with this reporter with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Katie Swatowski is with us in studio covering Broward County for us here at WLRN. And Katie, of course, this latest incident just is added to the long list of challenges that Broward County elections have had through the years, most notably a year ago with The recount. That's right, which led, of course, to Brenda Snipes, who had been the election supervisor, her departure, Pete Ananachi coming in, appointed by Governor Scott in this case. So kind of how does this latest thing kind of rank with the challenges that the elections office in Broward has been wrestling with?
Well, I've been covering the elections office in Broward now for a little over 2 years. And just in that amount of time, I've seen a lot of change. But if we're looking at from the recount that happened last November to right now, the shift in leadership has really looked very, very different from the complacency that Broward was used to. And so I don't think that this shift in leadership has really changed, at least the voters that I talked to, their confidence in especially the vote by mail system. I think a lot of Broward County residents, I'm not going to say most, but a lot of people are still not very confident in Broward. If you mail in a ballot, it's going to get counted. So that has really stayed with people, I think. But also there's just a new face, right? So Broward is a deeply blue county. And now we have a Republican, you know, a man with a business and legal background coming in to take over what we had one person in there for more than 15 years.
Right. Brenda Snipes had been
in there. Brenda Snipes. Right. And actually, Brenda Snipes is still very much in the Broward County political scene. I saw her this week at the swearing in of the new mayor, Dale Holness. And she got a standing ovation from a packed county commission chamber. So I think while voters still have a very bad taste in their mouth for her, she's still pretty beloved on the political sense of things.
You know, and this final notice mistake and the apology that has come since then kind of comes in this era of voter disenfranchisement,
yes,
of concerns about vote by mail, of concerns about voting registration, around even the implementation of Amendment 4. Of course.
Signature mismatches.
All of this. And so, and again, as we're building toward a big election, the 2020 cycle. So how is Broward County thinking about these even confidence issues?
I think voters are definitely moving away from wanting to vote by mail. And I think there's going to be, I think we're going to see a lot more people try to early vote or vote on site and go vote. I think there's going to be a bigger push for that. But I also think the office took off some bites with smaller elections with the change in leadership to make sure that things were running smoothly. There was an election in Coral Springs.
Right.
So they've had a tiny chance to build up to this and kind of work towards organizing themselves. But it's coming from a much more business organized approach, much less complacency than there was before. And one example of that is they've got a brand new website.
Larry, how about that? Kind of a little bit of spring training here for the elections office in Broward County with these municipal elections before the Super Bowl of 2020.
I think they're taking any practice they can get up before the big one. And they know it's going to be a big deal. So they're encouraging voters now, to prevent problems from happening, they're encouraging voters to go to the supervisor's website. That's BrowardSOE.org, Supervisor of Elections, BrowardSOE.org, and check your voter status. To make sure everything that's correct, your address is correct, and all the information there is correct. But the thing is about this final notice to be placed on the inactive voter list, one good part is it's very easy to get back from an inactive to an active voter. All you have to do is go and vote or call the office or request a vote by mail ballot. Any interaction with the office will kick you out of that inactive status and put you in back as an active voter.
A place that we're going to have to continue to watch, not just with Broward County, but continue to talk about, certainly, voting security and confidence in voting. Big, big issue here in South Florida ahead of the 2020 election. Katie Swetlowski, thank you for sharing your reporting with
us
here in studio. Always appreciate it, covering Broward County for us here at WLRN. And Larry Barshefsky, a reporter at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, with us as well in Broward County. Larry, always great to have you on the program, too. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Finally on the roundup this week, the Miami Book Fair is back on the streets of downtown Miami. Writers come to the area from all over the world, tables filled with books lining the streets around the Miami-Dade College's Wolfson campus. Four authors featured in WLRN's Sundial Book Club are speaking at the book fair this weekend. Each month, the club highlights a title by an author who's lived in Florida or whose story is rooted here. Here's a snapshot from some of those conversations with the Sundial Book Club. First up, Miami author Alex Segura.
I wanted to write about someone like me. I didn't want to write about me. I wanted to write about someone that maybe I knew in college or in high school and had the same kind of upbringing and life that I had in Miami.
I'm also like a third generation Central Floridian, and I write very extensively about Florida, but I grew up around a lot of taxidermy. I didn't make any taxidermy, but it was something that was like, there were like deer mounts up in my church. They're like in restaurants sometimes. There was some in my house, like all my friends' homes.
Death, I feel like, even as a young person, was something that sort of haunted me and fascinated me as a subject, because in many ways, it's an unsolvable subject.
My mother is the exception in that she's the one person I asked for permissions of what I could write about. The reason she didn't want me taking things out, she felt that she doesn't have necessarily the platform or vocabulary or skill set to render her experience as an addict, but she felt that I could kind of offer a beating heart and a pulse behind this kind of caricature of addict parent.
Just some of the South Florida authors or stories based in Florida that the Sundial Book Club has been reading over the past several months, and those authors in town for the Miami Book Fair: Alex Segura, Kristen Arnett, Edwige Danticat, and T. Kira Madden. They've been featured with the book club on Sundial over the past several months. You can join that book club. Look for Sundial Book Club on Facebook. And you can find out more of our book fair coverage on Facebook as well. Look for WLRN. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexandra Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Leprey. Teresa Furtado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mayers. WLRN's director of radio programming and technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, texting, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.